How utterly foreign to the troubles of the night were those exciting St. Petersburg mornings, when the fierce and tender, damp and dazzling Arctic spring bundled away broken ice down the sea-bright Neva. It made the roofs shine. It painted the slush in the streets a rich purplish blue shade, which I have never seen anywhere since. On those glorious days, on allait se promener en équipage, the old-world expression current in our set. I can easily re-feel the exhilarating change from the thickly padded, knee-length polo shubok with the hot beaver collar to the short, navy-blue coat with its anchor-patterned brass buttons. In the open landau, I am joined by the valley of a lap rug to the occupants of the more interesting back seat, majestic Mademoiselle and triumphant, tear-bedabbled Sergei, with whom I have just had a row at home. I am kicking him slightly now and then under our common cover, until Mademoiselle sternly tells me to stop. We drift past the show windows of Fabergé, whose mineral monstrosities, jeweled troikas poised on marble ostrich eggs and the like, highly appreciated by the imperial family, were emblems of grotesque garishness to ours. Church bells are ringing. The first brimstone flies up over the palace arch. In another month, we shall return to the country. And as I look up, I can see, strung on ropes from house front to house front, high above the street, great, tensely smooth, semi-transparent banners billowing, their three wide bands, pale red, pale blue, and merely pale, deprived by the sun and the flying cloud shadows of any too blunt connection with a national holiday, but undoubtedly celebrating now, in the city of memory, the essence of that spring day, the swish of the mud, the beginning of mumps, the ruffled exotic bird with one bloodshot eye on Mademoiselle's hat. 6. She spent 7 years with us, lessons getting rarer and rarer, and her temper worse and worse. Still, she seemed like a rock of grim permanence when compared to the ebb and flow of English governesses and Russian tutors passing through our large household. She was on bad terms with all of them. In summer, seldom less than 15 people sat down for meals, and when on birthdays this number rose to 30 or more, the question of place at table became a particularly burning one for Mademoiselle. Uncles and aunts and cousins would arrive on such days from neighboring estates, and the village doctor would come in his dog cart, and the village schoolmaster would be heard blowing his nose in the cool hall, where he passed from mirror to mirror with a greenish, damp, creaking bouquet of lilies of the valley, or a sky-colored, brittle one of cornflowers in his fist. If Mademoiselle found herself seated too far at the end of the huge table, and especially if she lost precedence to a certain poor relative who was almost as fat as she, "Je suis une sylphide à côté d'elle," Mademoiselle would say with a shrug of contempt. Then her sense of injury caused her lips to twitch in a would-be ironical smile. And when a naive neighbor would smile back, she would rapidly shake her head, as if coming out of some very deep meditation, with the remark, "Excusez-moi, je souriais à mes tristes pensées." And as though nature had not wished to spare her anything that makes one supersensitive, she was hard of hearing. Sometimes at table we boys would suddenly become aware of two big tears crawling down Mademoiselle's ample cheeks. "Don't mind me," she would say in a small voice, and she kept on eating until the unwiped tears blinded her. Then, with a heartbroken hiccup, she would rise and blunder out of the dining room. Little by little, the truth would come out. The general talk had turned, say, on the subject of the warship my uncle commanded, and she had perceived in this a sly dig at her Switzerland that had no navy. Or else it was because she fancied that whenever French was spoken, the game consisted in deliberately preventing her from directing and adorning the conversation. Poor lady, she was always in such a nervous hurry to seize control of intelligible table talk before it bolted back into Russian that no wonder she bungled her cue. "And your parliament, sir, how is it getting along?" she would suddenly burst out brightly from her end of the table, challenging my father, who, after a harassing day, was not exactly eager to discuss troubles of the state with a singularly unreal person who neither knew nor cared anything about them. Thinking that someone had referred to music, But silence, too, may be beautiful, she would bubble. Why, one evening, in a desolate valley of the Alps, I actually heard silence. Sallies like these, especially when growing deafness led her to answer questions none had put, resulted in a painful hush, instead of touching off the rockets of a sprightly causerie. And really, her French was so lovely. Ought one to have minded the shallowness of her culture, the bitterness of her temper, the banality of her mind, when that pearly language of hers purled and scintillated, as innocent of sense as the alliterative sins of Racine's pious verse? My father's library, not her limited lore, taught me to appreciate authentic poetry. Nevertheless, something of her tongue's limpidity and luster has had a singularly bracing effect upon me, like those sparkling salts that are used to purify the blood. This is why it makes me so sad to imagine now the anguish Mademoiselle must have felt at seeing how lost, how little valued, was the nightingale voice which came from her elephantine body. She stayed with us long, much too long, obstinately hoping for some miracle that would transform her into a kind of Madame de Rambouillet, holding a gilt and satin salon of poets, princes, and statesmen under her brilliant spell. She would have gone on hoping, had it not been for one Lenski, a young Russian tutor with mild myopic eyes and strong political opinions, who had been engaged to coach us in various subjects and participate in our sports. He had had several predecessors, none of whom Mademoiselle had liked, but he, as she put it, was le comble. While venerating my father, Lenski could not quite stomach certain aspects of our household, such as footmen and French, which last he considered an aristocratic convention of no use in a liberal's home. On the other hand, Mademoiselle decided that if Lenski answered her point-blank questions only with short grunts, which he tried to Germanize for want of a better language, it was not because he could not understand French, but because he wished to insult her in front of everybody. I can hear and see Mademoiselle requesting him in dulcet tones, but with an ominous quiver of her upper lip, to pass her the bread. And likewise I can hear and see Lenski, Frenchlessly and unflinchingly going on with his soup. Finally, with a slashing, "Pardon, monsieur," Mademoiselle would swoop right across his plate, snatch up the breadbasket, and recoil again with a "Merci," so charged with irony that Lenski's downy ears would turn the hue of geraniums. "The brute, the cad, the nihilist," she would sob later in her room, which was no longer next to ours, though still on the same floor. If Lenski happened to come tripping downstairs, while with an asthmatic pause every 10 steps or so she was working her way up, for the little hydraulic elevator of our house in St. Petersburg would constantly and rather insultingly refuse to function, Mademoiselle maintained that he had viciously bumped into her, pushed her, knocked her down, and we already could see him trampling her prostrate body. More and more frequently she would leave the table, and the dessert she would have missed was diplomatically sent up in her wake. From her remote room she would write a 16-page letter to my mother, who, upon hurrying upstairs, would find her dramatically packing her trunk. And then, one day, she was allowed to go on with her packing. 7. She returned to Switzerland. World War I came, then the Revolution. In the early 20s, long after our correspondence had fizzled out, by a fluke move of life in exile, I chanced to visit Lausanne with a college friend of mine, so I thought I might as well look up Mademoiselle if she were still alive. She was. Stouter than ever, quite gray, and almost totally deaf, she welcomed me with a tumultuous outbreak of affection. Instead of the Chateau de Chillon picture, there was now one of a garish troika. She spoke as warmly of her life in Russia as if it were her own lost homeland. Indeed, I found in the neighborhood quite a colony of such old Swiss governesses. Huddled together in a constant seething of competitive reminiscences, they formed a small island in an environment that had grown alien to them. Mademoiselle's bosom friend was now mummy-like Mademoiselle Golay, my mother's former governess, still prim and pessimistic at 85. She had remained in our family long after my mother had married, and her return to Switzerland had preceded only by a couple of years that of Mademoiselle, with whom she had not been on speaking terms when both had been living under our roof. One is always at home in one's past, which partly explains those pathetic ladies' posthumous love for a remote and, to be perfectly frank, rather appalling country, which they never had really known, and in which none of them had been very content. As no conversation was possible because of Mademoiselle's deafness, my friend and I decided to bring her next day the appliance which we gathered she could not afford. She adjusted the clumsy thing improperly at first, but no sooner had she done so than she turned to me with a dazzled look of moist wonder and bliss in her eyes. She swore she could hear every word, every murmur of mine. She could not, for having my doubts, I had not spoken. If I had, I would have told her to thank my friend who had paid for the instrument. Was it, then, silence she heard, that alpine silence she had talked about in the past? In that past she had been lying to herself. Now she was lying to me. Before leaving for Basel and Berlin, I happened to be walking along the lake in the cold, misty night. At one spot, a lone light dimly diluted the darkness and transformed the mist into a visible drizzle. "Il pleut toujours en Suisse," was one of those casual comments which formerly had made Mademoiselle weep. Below, a wide ripple, almost a wave, and something vaguely white attracted my eye. As I came quite close to the lapping water, I saw what it was, an aged swan, a large, uncouth, dodo-like creature, making ridiculous efforts to hoist himself onto a moored boat. He could not do it. The heavy, impotent flapping of his wings, their slippery sound against the rocking and plashing boat, the gluey glistening of the dark swell where it caught the light, all seemed for a moment laden with that strange significance which sometimes in dreams is attached to a finger pressed to mute lips, and then pointed at something the dreamer has no time to distinguish before waking with a start. But although I soon forgot that dismal night, it was, oddly enough, that night, that compound image, shudder and swan and swell, which first came to my mind when a couple of years later I learned that Mademoiselle had died. She had spent all her life in feeling miserable. This misery was her native element. Its fluctuations, its varying depths alone gave her the impression of moving and living. What bothers me is that a sense of misery and nothing else is not enough to make a permanent soul. My enormous and morose Mademoiselle is all right on earth, but impossible in eternity. Have I really salvaged her from fiction? Just before the rhythm I hear falters and fades, I catch myself wondering whether, during the years I knew her, I had not kept utterly missing something in her that was far more she than her chins, or her ways, or even her French. Something perhaps akin to that last glimpse of her, to the radiant deceit she had used in order to have me depart pleased with my own kindness, or to that swan, whose agony was so much closer to artistic truth than a drooping dancer's pale arms. Something, in short, that I could appreciate only after the things and beings that I had most loved in the security of my childhood had been turned to ashes or shot through the heart. There is an appendix to Mademoiselle's story. When I first wrote it, I did not know about certain amazing survivals. Thus, in 1960, my London cousin, Peter de Peterson, told me that their English nanny, who had seemed old to me in 1904 in Abbazia, was by now over 90 and in good health. Neither was I aware that the governess of my father's two youngest sisters, Mademoiselle Bouvier, later Madame Conrad, survived my father by almost half a century. She had entered their household in 1889 and stayed 6 years, being the last in a series of governesses. A pretty little keepsake drawn in 1895 by Ivan de Peterson, Peter's father, shows various events of life at Batovo, vignetted over an inscription in my father's hand. À celle qui a toujours su se faire aimer et qui ne saura jamais se faire oublier. Signatures must have been appended by four young male Nabokovs and three of their sisters, Natalia, Elizaveta, and Nadezhda, as well as by Natalia's husband, their little son Mitik, two girl cousins, and Ivan Alexandrovich Tihotsky, the Russian tutor. 65 years later, in Geneva, my sister Elena discovered Madame Conrad, now in her 10th decade. The ancient lady, skipping one generation, naively mistook Elena for our mother, then a girl of 18 who used to drive up with Mademoiselle Golay from Vira to Batovo, in those distant times whose long light finds so many ingenious ways to reach me. Chapter 6 1 On a summer morning, in the legendary Russia of my boyhood, my first glance upon awakening was for the chink between the white inner shutters. If it disclosed a watery pallor, one had better not open them at all, and so be spared the sight of a sullen day sitting for its picture in a puddle. How resentfully one would deduce from a line of dull light the leaden sky, the sodden sand, the gruel-like mess of broken brown blossoms under the lilacs, and that flat, fallow leaf, the first casualty of the season, pasted upon a wet garden bench. But if the chink was a long glint of dewy brilliancy, then I made haste to have the window yield its treasure. With one blow the room would be cleft into light and shade. The foliage of birches moving in the sun had the translucent green tone of grapes, and in contrast to this there was the dark velvet of fir trees against a blue of extraordinary intensity, the like of which I discovered only many years later in the Montan zone of Colorado. From the age of 7, everything I felt in connection with a rectangle of framed sunlight was dominated by a single passion. If my first glance of the morning was for the sun, my first thought was for the butterflies it would engender. The original event had been banal enough. On the honeysuckle overhanging the carved back of a bench just opposite the main entrance, my guiding angel, whose wings, except for the absence of a Florentine limbus, resemble those of Fra Angelico's Gabriel, pointed out to me a rare visitor, a splendid, pale-yellow creature with black blotches, blue crenels, and a cinnabar eye-spot above each chrome-rimmed black tail. As it probed the inclined flower from which it hung, its powdery body slightly bent, it kept restlessly jerking its great wings, and my desire for it was one of the most intense I have ever experienced. Agil Ustin, our townhouse janitor, who for a comic reason explained elsewhere, happened to be that summer in the country with us, somehow managed to catch it in my cap, after which it was transferred, cap and all, to a wardrobe, where domestic naphthalene was fondly expected by Mademoiselle to kill it overnight. On the following morning, however, when she unlocked the wardrobe to take something out, my swallowtail, with a mighty rustle, flew into her face, then made for the open window, and presently was but a golden speck, dipping and dodging and soaring eastward over timber and tundra to Vologda, Viatka, and Perm, and beyond the gaunt Ural range to Yakutsk and Verkhne-Kolymsk, and from Verkhne-Kolymsk, where it lost a tail, to the fair island of St. Lawrence, and across Alaska to Dawson and southward along the Rocky Mountains, to be finally overtaken and captured, after a 40-year race, on an immigrant dandelion under an endemic aspen near Boulder. In a letter from Mr. Brune to Mr. Rawlins, June 14, 1735, in the Bodleian Collection, he states that one Mr. Vernon followed a butterfly 9 miles before he could catch him. The Recreative Review of Eccentricities of Literature and Life, Volume 1, page 144, London, 1821. Soon after the wardrobe affair, I found a spectacular moth marooned in a corner of a vestibule window, and my mother dispatched it with ether. In later years, I used many killing agents, but the least contact with the initial stuff would always cause the porch of the past to light up and attract that blundering beauty. Once, as a grown man, I was under ether during appendectomy, and with the vividness of a decalcomania picture, I saw my own self in a sailor suit, mounting a freshly emerged emperor moth under the guidance of a Chinese lady who I knew was my mother. It was all there, brilliantly reproduced in my dream, while my own vitals were being exposed. The soaking ice-cold absorbent cotton pressed to the insect's Lemurian head, the subsiding spasms of its body, the satisfying crackle produced by the pin penetrating the hard crust of its thorax, the careful insertion of the point of the pin in the cork-bottomed groove of the spreading board, the symmetrical adjustment of the thick, strong-veined wings under neatly affixed strips of semi-transparent paper. 2. I must have been 8 when, in a storeroom of our country house, among all kinds of dusty objects, I discovered some wonderful books acquired in the days when my mother's mother had been interested in natural science and had had a famous university professor of zoology, Shimkevich, give private lessons to her daughter. Some of these books were mere curios, such as the 4 huge brown folios of Alberto Seba's work, Locupletissimi Rerum Naturalium Thesauri Accurata Descriptio, printed in Amsterdam around 1750. On their coarse-grained pages I found woodcuts of serpents and butterflies and embryos. The fetus of an Ethiopian female child hanging by the neck in a glass jar used to give me a nasty shock every time I came across it. Nor did I much care for the stuffed hydra on plate Roman numeral 102, with its 7 lion-toothed turtle heads on 7 serpentine necks, and its strange bloated body which bore button-like tubercules along the sides and ended in a knotted tail. Other books I found in that attic, among herbariums full of alpine columbines and blue pelimoniums and Jove's campions and orange-red lilies and other Davos flowers, came closer to my subject. I took in my arms and carried downstairs glorious loads of fantastically attractive volumes. Maria Sibylla Merian's 1647 to 1717 lovely plates of Suriname insects, and Esper's noble Die Schmetterlinge, Erlangen, 1777, and Bois Duval's Icône historique de l'épidoptère nouveau ou peu connu, Paris, begun in 1832. Still more exciting were the products of the latter half of the century, Newman's Natural History of British Butterflies and Moths, Hoffmann's Die Großschmetterlinge Europas, the Grand Duke Nikolai Mihailovich's memoirs on Asiatic Lepidoptera, with incomparably beautiful figures painted by Kavrygin, Rybakov, Lang, Scudder's stupendous work on the butterflies of New England. Retrospectively, the summer of 1905, though quite vivid in many ways, is not animated yet by a single bit of quick flutter or colored fluff around or across the walks with the village schoolmaster. The swallowtail of June 1906 was still in the larval stage on a roadside umbellifer. But in the course of that month I became acquainted with a score or so of common things, and Mademoiselle was already referring to a certain forest road that culminated in a marshy meadow full of small, pearl-bordered fritillaries, thus called in my first unforgettable and unfadingly magical little manual, Richard South's The Butterflies of the British Isles, which had just come out at the time, as Le Chemin des Papillons Bruns. The following year I became aware that many of our butterflies and moths did not occur in England or Central Europe, and more complete atlases helped me to determine them. A severe illness, pneumonia, with fever up to 41 degrees centigrade, in the beginning of 1907, mysteriously abolished the rather monstrous gift of numbers that had made of me a child prodigy during a few months. Today I cannot multiply 13 by 17 without pencil and paper. I can add them up, though, in a trice, the teeth of the 3 fitting in neatly. But the butterflies survived. My mother accumulated a library and a museum around my bed, and the longing to describe a new species completely replaced that of discovering a new prime number. A trip to Biarritz in August 1907 added new wonders, though not as lucid and numerous as they were to be in 1909. By 1908, I had gained absolute control over the European Lepidoptera as known to Hoffmann. By 1910, I had dreamed my way through the first volumes of Zeitz's prodigious picture book, Die Großschmetterlinge der Erde, had purchased a number of rarities recently described, and was voraciously reading entomological periodicals, especially English and Russian ones. Great upheavals were taking place in the development of systematics. Since the middle of the century, continental lepidopterology had been, on the whole, a simple and stable affair, smoothly run by the Germans. Its high priest, Dr. Staudinger, was also the head of the largest firm of insect dealers. Even now, half a century after his death, German lepidopterists have not quite managed to shake off the hypnotic spell occasioned by his authority. He was still alive when his school began to lose ground as a scientific force in the world. While he and his followers stuck to specific and generic names sanctioned by long usage and were content to classify butterflies by characters visible to the naked eye, English-speaking authors were introducing nomenclatorial changes as a result of strict application of the law of priority and taxonomic changes based on the microscopic study of organs. The Germans did their best to ignore the new trends and continued to cherish the philately-like side of entomology. Their solicitude for the average collector who should not be made to dissect is comparable to the way nervous publishers of popular novels pamper the average reader who should not be made to think. There was another more general change, which coincided with my ardent adolescent interest in butterflies and moths. The Victorian and Staudingerian kind of species, hermetic and homogeneous, with sundry, alpine, polar, insular, etc., varieties affixed to it from the outside, as it were, like incidental appendages, was replaced by a new, multiform and fluid kind of species, organically consisting of geographical races or subspecies. The evolutional aspects of the case were thus brought out more clearly by means of more flexible methods of classification, and further links between butterflies and the central problems of nature were provided by biological investigations. The mysteries of mimicry had a special attraction for me. Its phenomena showed an artistic perfection usually associated with man-wrought things. Consider the imitation of oozing poison by bubble-like macules on a wing, complete with pseudo-refraction, or by glossy yellow knobs on a chrysalis. Don't eat me, I have already been squashed, sampled, and rejected. Consider the tricks of an acrobatic caterpillar, of the lobster moth, which in infancy looks like bird's dung, but after molting develops scrabbly hymenopteroid appendages and baroque characteristics, allowing the extraordinary fellow to play two parts at once, like the actor in Oriental shows who becomes a pair of intertwisted wrestlers, that of a writhing larva and that of a big ant, seemingly harrowing it. When a certain moth resembles a certain wasp in shape and color, it also walks and moves its antennae in a waspish, unmoth-like manner. When a butterfly has to look like a leaf, not only are all the details of a leaf beautifully rendered, but markings mimicking grub-bored holes are generously thrown in. Natural selection, in the Darwinian sense, could not explain the miraculous coincidence of imitative aspect and imitative behavior, nor could one appeal to the theory of the struggle for life when a protective device was carried to a point of mimetic subtlety, exuberance, and luxury far in excess of a predator's power of appreciation. I discovered in nature the non-utilitarian delights that I sought in art. Both were a form of magic. Both were a game of intricate enchantment and deception. 3. I have hunted butterflies in various climes and disguises. As a pretty boy in knickerbockers and sailor cap. As a lanky cosmopolitan expatriate in flannel bags and beret. As a fat, hatless old man in shorts. Most of my cabinets have shared the fate of our Vera house. Those in our townhouse and the small addendum I left in the Yalta Museum have been destroyed, no doubt, by carpet beetles and other pests. A collection of South European stuff that I started in exile vanished in Paris during World War II. All my American captures from 1940 to 1960, several thousands of specimens, including great rarities and types, are in the Museum of Comparative Zoology, the American Natural History Museum, and the Cornell University Museum of Entomology, where they are safer than they would be in Tomsk or Atomsk. Incredibly happy memories, quite comparable, in fact, to those of my Russian boyhood, are associated with my research work at the MCZ, Cambridge, Mass., 1941 to 1948. No less happy have been the many collecting trips taken almost every summer during 20 years through most of the states of my adopted country. In Jackson Hole and in the Grand Canyon, on the mountain slopes above Telluride, Colorado, and on a celebrated pine barren near Albany, New York, dwell and will dwell in generations more numerous than additions the butterflies I have described as new. Several of my finds have been dealt with by other workers. Some have been named after me. One of these, Nabokov's pug, Eupithecia Nabokovi McDonough, which I boxed one night in 1943 on a picture window of James Laughlin's Alta Lodge in Utah, fits most philosophically into the thematic spiral that began in a wood on the Oradej around 1910, or perhaps even earlier, on that Nova Zemblian River a century and a half ago. Few things indeed have I known in the way of emotion or appetite, ambition or achievement, that could surpass in richness and strength the excitement of entomological exploration. From the very first, it had a great many intertwinkling facets. One of them was the acute desire to be alone, since any companion, no matter how quiet, interfered with the concentrated enjoyment of my mania. Its gratification admitted of no compromise or exception. Already when I was 10, tutors and governesses knew that the morning was mine and cautiously kept away. In this connection, I remember the visit of a schoolmate, a boy of whom I was very fond and with whom I had excellent fun. He arrived one summer night, in 1913, I think, from a town some 25 miles away. His father had recently perished in an accident, the family was ruined, and the stout-hearted lad, not being able to afford the price of a railway ticket, had bicycled all those miles to spend a few days with me. On the morning following his arrival, I did everything I could to get out of the house for my morning hike without his knowing where I had gone. Breakfastless, with hysterical haste, I gathered my net, pillboxes, killing jar, and escaped through the window. Once in the forest, I was safe. But still I walked on, my calves quaking, my eyes full of scalding tears, the whole of me twitching with shame and self-disgust, as I visualized my poor friend, with his long pale face and black tie, moping in the hot garden, patting the panting dogs for want of something better to do, and trying hard to justify my absence to himself. Let me look at my demon objectively. With the exception of my parents, no one really understood my obsession. And it was many years before I met a fellow sufferer. One of the first things I learned was not to depend on others for the growth of my collection. One summer afternoon in 1911, Mademoiselle came into my room, book in hand, started to say she wanted to show me how wittily Rousseau denounced zoology in favor of botany, and by then was too far gone in the gravitational process of lowering her bulk into an armchair to be stopped by my howl of anguish. On that seat, I had happened to leave a glass-lidded cabinet tray with long, lovely series of the large white. Her first reaction was one of stung vanity. Her weight, surely, could not be accused of damaging what, in fact, it had demolished. Her second was to console me. "Allons donc, ce ne sont que des papillons de potager," which only made matters worse. A Sicilian pear recently purchased from Staudinger had been crushed and bruised. A giant Biarritz sample was utterly mangled. Smashed, too, were some of my choicest local captures. Of these, an aberration resembling the Canarian race of the species might have been mended with a few drops of glue, but a precious gynandromorph, left side male, right side female, whose abdomen could not be traced and whose wings had come off, was lost forever. One might reattach the wings, but one could not prove that all four belonged to that headless thorax on its bent pin. Next morning, with an air of great mystery, poor Mademoiselle set off for St. Petersburg, and came back in the evening bringing me something better than your cabbage butterflies, a banal Urania moth mounted on plaster. "How you hugged me! How you danced with joy!" she exclaimed 10 years later in the course of inventing a brand new past. Our country doctor, with whom I had left the pupae of a rare moth when I went on a journey abroad, wrote me that everything had hatched finely. But in reality, a mouse had got at the precious pupae, and upon my return the deceitful old man produced some common tortoise-shell butterflies, which I presume he had hurriedly caught in his garden and popped into the breeding cage as plausible substitutes, so he thought. Better than he was an enthusiastic kitchen boy who would sometimes borrow my equipment and come back 2 hours later in triumph with a bag full of seething invertebrate life and several additional items. Loosening the mouth of the net, which he had tied up with a string, he would pour out his cornucopian spoil, a mass of grasshoppers, some sand, the two parts of a mushroom he had thriftily plucked on the way home, more grasshoppers, more sand, and one battered small white. In the works of major Russian poets, I can discover only two lepidopteral images of genuinely sensuous quality. Bunin's impeccable evocation of what is certainly a tortoiseshell, and there will fly into the room a colored butterfly in silk to flutter, rustle, and pit-pat on the blue ceiling. And Fett's butterfly, soliloquizing, "Whence have I come, and whither am I hasting? Do not inquire. Now on a graceful flower I have settled, and now respire." In French poetry, one is struck by Musset's well-known lines in Le Sol. "Le phalène doré, dans sa course légère, traverse les prés embaumés," which is an absolutely exact description of the crepuscular flight of the male of the geometrid called in England the orange moth. And there is Farg's fascinatingly apt phrase in Les Quatre Journées, about a garden which at nightfall se glace de bleu comme l'ail du grand Sylvain, the poplar admirable. And among the very few genuine lepidopterological images in English poetry, my favorite is Browning's, "On our other side is the straight-up rock, and a path is kept twixt the gorge and it by boulder stones where lichens mock the marks on the moth, and small ferns fit their teeth to the polished block," by the fireside. It is astounding how little the ordinary person notices butterflies. "None," calmly replied that sturdy Swiss hiker with Camus in his rucksack when purposely asked by me for the benefit of my incredulous companion if he had seen any butterflies while descending the trail where a moment before you and I had been delighting in swarms of them. It is also true that when I call up the image of a particular path remembered in minute detail, but pertaining to a summer before that of 1906, preceding, that is, the date on my first locality label and never revisited, I fail to make out one wing, one wing beat, one azure flash, one moth-gemmed flower, as if an evil spell had been cast on the Adriatic coast, making all its leps, as the slangier among us say, invisible. Exactly thus an entomologist may feel some day when plodding beside a jubilant and already helmetless botanist amid the hideous flora of a parallel planet with not a single insect in sight. And thus, in odd proof of the odd fact that whenever possible the scenery of our infancy is used by an economically minded producer as a ready-made setting for our adult dreams, the seaside hilltop of a certain recurrent nightmare of mine, whereinto I smuggle a collapsible net from my waking state, is gay with thyme and melilot, but incomprehensibly devoid of all the butterflies that should be there. I also found out very soon that a lepist, indulging in his quiet quest, was apt to provoke strange reactions in other creatures. How often, when a picnic had been arranged, and I would be self-consciously trying to get my humble implements unnoticed into the tar-smelling charabanc, a tar preparation was used to keep flies away from the horses, or the tea-smelling opal convertible, benzene 40 years ago smelled that way, some cousin or aunt of mine would remark, "Must you really take that net with you? Can't you enjoy yourself like a normal boy? Don't you think you are spoiling everybody's pleasure?" Near a sign, "Nach Bodenlaube," at Bad Kissingen, Bavaria, just as I was about to join for a long walk, my father and majestic old Muromtsev, who 4 years before, in 1906, had been president of the first Russian parliament, the latter turned his marble head toward me, a vulnerable boy of 11, and said with his famous solemnity, "Come with us by all means, but do not chase butterflies, child. It spoils the rhythm of the walk." On a path above the Black Sea in the Crimea, among shrubs in waxy bloom in March 1918, a bow-legged Bolshevik sentry attempted to arrest me for signaling, with my net, he said, to a British warship. In the summer of 1929, every time I walked through a village in the Eastern Pyrenees and happened to look back, I would see in my wake the villagers frozen in the various attitudes my passage had caught them in, as if I were Sodom and they Lot's wife. A decade later, in the Maritime Alps, I once noticed the grass undulate in a serpentine way behind me because a fat rural policeman was wriggling after me on his belly to find out if I were not trapping songbirds. America has shown even more of this morbid interest in my retiary activities than other countries have, perhaps because I was in my 40s when I came there to live, and the older the man, the queerer he looks with a butterfly net in his hand. Stern farmers have drawn my attention to no-fishing signs. From cars passing me on the highway have come wild howls of derision. Sleepy dogs, though unmindful of the worst bum, have perked up and come at me snarling. Tiny tots have pointed me out to their puzzled mamas. Broad-minded vacationists have asked me whether I was catching bugs for bait. And one morning on a wasteland lit by tall yuccas in bloom near Santa Fe, a big black mare followed me for more than a mile. 4. When, having shaken off all pursuers, I took the rough red road that ran from our Vera house toward field and forest, the animation and luster of the day seemed like a tremor of sympathy around me. Very fresh, very dark Aran browns, which emerged only every second year, conveniently retrospection has fallen here into line, flitted among the firs, or revealed their red markings and checkered fringes as they sunned themselves on the roadside bracken. Hopping above the grass, a diminutive ringlet called Hero dodged my net. Several moths, too, were flying, gaudy sunlovers that sail from flower to flower like painted flies, or male insomniacs in search of hidden females, such as that rust-colored oak agar hurtling across the shrubbery. I noticed, one of the major mysteries of my childhood, a soft, pale green wing caught in a spider's web. By then I knew what it was, part of a large emerald. The tremendous larva of the goat moth, ostentatiously segmented, flat-headed, flesh-colored, and glossily flushed, a strange creature, as naked as a worm, to use a French comparison, crossed my path in frantic search for a place to pupate, the awful pressure of metamorphosis, the aura of a disgraceful fit in a public place. On the bark of that birch tree, the stout one near the park wicket, I had found last spring a dark aberration of Sievers's Carmelite, just another gray moth to the reader. In the ditch, under the bridgelet, a bright yellow Silvius Skipper hobnobbed with a dragonfly. Just a blue Libellula to me. From a flowerhead, two male coppers rose to a tremendous height, fighting all the way up, and then after a while came the downward flash of one of them returning to his thistle. These were familiar insects, but at any moment something better might cause me to stop with a quick intake of breath. I remember one day when I warily brought my net closer and closer to an uncommon hair streak that had daintily settled on a sprig. I could clearly see the white W on its chocolate-brown underside. Its wings were closed, and the inferior ones were rubbing against each other in a curious circular motion, possibly producing some small, blithe crepitation pitched too high for a human ear to catch. I had long wanted that particular species, and when near enough, I struck. You have heard champion tennis players moan after muffing an easy shot. You may have seen the face of the world-famous grandmaster, Wilhelm Edmundson, when, during a simultaneous display in a Minsk cafe, he lost his rook, by an absurd oversight, to the local amateur and pediatrician, Dr. Schach, who eventually won. But that day, nobody, except my older self, could see me shake out a piece of twig from an otherwise empty net and stare at a hole in the tarlatan. 5. Near the intersection of two carriage roads, one well-kept running north-south in between our old and new parks, and the other muddy and rutty, leading, if you turned west, to Batovo, at a spot where aspens crowded on both sides of a dip, I would be sure to find in the third week of June great blue-black nympholids, striped with pure white, gliding and wheeling low above the rich clay which matched the tint of their undersides when they settled and closed their wings. Those were the dung-loving males of what the old Aurelians used to call the poplar admirable, or, more exactly, they belonged to its Buchovinan subspecies. As a boy of 9, not knowing that race, I noticed how much our northern Russian specimens differed from the central European form figured in Hoffman, and rashly wrote to Kuznetsov, one of the greatest Russian or indeed world lepidopterists of all time, naming my new subspecies Limenitis populi russica. A long month later he returned my description and aquarelle of Russica Nabokov, with only two words scribbled on the back of my letter. Bukovinensis Hormuzaki. How I hated Hormuzaki. And how hurt I was when in one of Kuznetsov's later papers I found a gruff reference to schoolboys who keep naming minute varieties of the poplar nymph. Undaunted, however, by the populi flop, I discovered the following year a new moth. That summer I had been collecting assiduously on moonless nights in a glade of the park by spreading a bedsheet over the grass and its annoyed glowworms, and casting upon it the light of an acetylene lamp, which 6 years later was to shine on Tamara. Into that arena of radiance, moths would come drifting out of the solid blackness around me, and it was in that manner upon that magic sheet that I took a beautiful Plusia, now Phytometra, which, as I saw at once, differed from its closest ally by its mauve and maroon instead of golden-brown forewings and narrower bractea mark, and was not recognizably figured in any of my books. I sent its description and picture to Richard South for publication in The Entomologist. He did not know it either, but with the utmost kindness checked it in the British Museum collection and found it had been described long ago as Plusia excelsa by Kretschmar. I received the sad news, which was most sympathetically worded, should be congratulated for obtaining very rare Vulgan thing, admirable figure, with the utmost stoicism. But many years later, by a pretty fluke, I know I should not point out these plums to people, I got even with the first discoverer of my moth by giving his own name to a blind man in a novel. Let me also evoke the hawk moths, the jets of my boyhood. Colors would die a long death on June evenings. The lilac shrubs in full bloom before which I stood, net in hand, displayed clusters of a fluffy gray in the dusk, the ghost of purple. A moist young moon hung above the mist of a neighboring meadow. In many a garden have I stood thus in later years, in Athens, Antibes, Atlanta, but never have I waited with such a keen desire as before those darkening lilacs. And suddenly it would come, the low buzz passing from flower to flower, the vibrational halo around the streamlined body of an olive and pink hummingbird moth poised in the air above the corolla into which it had dipped its long tongue. Its handsome black larva, resembling a diminutive cobra when it puffed out its oscillated front segments, could be found on dank willow herb 2 months later. Thus, every hour and season had its delights. And finally, on cold or even frosty autumn nights, one could sugar for moths by painting tree trunks with a mixture of molasses, beer, and rum. Through the gusty blackness, one's lantern would illumine the stickily glistening furrows of the bark, and two or three large moths upon it imbibing the sweets, their nervous wings half open butterfly fashion, the lower ones exhibiting their incredible crimson silk from beneath the lichen-gray primaries. Catocala adultera, I would triumphantly shriek in the direction of the lighted windows of the house as I stumbled home to show my captures to my father. 6. The English park that separated our house from the hayfields was an extensive and elaborate affair, with labyrinthine paths, Turgenevian benches, and imported oaks among the endemic firs and birches. The struggle that had gone on since my grandfather's time to keep the park from reverting to its wild state always fell short of complete success. No gardener could cope with the hillocks of frizzly black earth that the pink hands of moles kept heaping on the tidy sand of the main walk. Weeds and fungi and ridge-like tree roots crossed and recrossed the sun-flecked trails. Bears had been eliminated in the 80s, but an occasional moose still visited the grounds. On a picturesque boulder, a little mountain ash and a still smaller aspen had climbed, holding hands, like two clumsy, shy children. Other, more elusive trespassers, lost picnickers or merry villagers, would drive our hoary gamekeeper Ivan crazy by scrawling ribald words on the benches and gates. The disintegrating process continues still, in a different sense, for when nowadays I attempt to follow in memory the winding paths from one given point to another, I notice with alarm that there are many gaps, due to oblivion or ignorance, akin to the terra incognita blanks mapmakers of old used to call sleeping beauties. Beyond the park there were fields, with a continuous shimmer of butterfly wings over a shimmer of flowers, daisies, bluebells, scabious, and others, which now rapidly pass by me in a kind of colored haze, like those lovely, lush meadows, never to be explored, that one sees from the diner on a transcontinental journey. At the end of this grassy wonderland, the forest rose like a wall. There I roamed, scanning the tree trunks, the enchanted, the silent part of a tree, for certain tiny moths, called pugs in England, delicate little creatures that cling in the daytime to speckled surfaces with which their flat wings and turned-up abdomens blend. There, at the bottom of that sea of sunshot greenery, I slowly spun round the great bowls. Nothing in the world would have seemed sweeter to me than to be able to add, by a stroke of luck, some remarkable new species to the long list of pugs already named by others. And my pied imagination, ostensibly and almost grotesquely, groveling to my desire, but all the time in ghostly conspiracies behind the scenes, coolly planning the most distant events of my destiny, kept providing me with hallucinatory samples of small print, the only specimen so far known. The only specimen known of Eupithecia petropolitanata was taken by a Russian schoolboy, by a young Russian collector, by myself in the government of St. Petersburg, Tsarskoye Selo district, in 1910, 1911, 1912, 1913. And then, 30 years later, that blessed black night in the Wasatch Range. At first, when I was, say, 8 or 9, I seldom roamed farther than the fields and woods between Vera and Batovo. Later, when aiming at a particular spot 6 miles or more distant, I would use a bicycle to get there, with my net strapped to the frame. But not many forest paths were passable on wheels. It was possible to ride there on horseback, of course. But because of our ferocious Russian tabanids, one could not leave a horse haltered in a wood for any length of time. My spirited bay almost climbed up the tree it was tied to one day trying to elude them. Big fellows, with watered silk eyes and tiger bodies, and gray little runts with an even more painful proboscis, but much more sluggish. To dispatch 2 or 3 of these dingy tipplers with one crush of the gloved hand as they glued themselves to the neck of my mount afforded me a wonderful empathic relief, which a dipterist might not appreciate. Anyway, on my butterfly hunts I always preferred hiking to any other form of locomotion, except naturally a flying seat gliding leisurely over the plant mats and rocks of an unexplored mountain, or hovering just above the flowery roof of a rainforest. For when you walk, especially in a region you have studied well, there is an exquisite pleasure in departing from one's itinerary to visit here and there by the wayside this glade, that glen, this or that combination of soil and flora, to drop in, as it were, on a familiar butterfly in his particular habitat, in order to see if he has emerged, and if so, how he is doing. There came a July day, around 1910, I suppose, when I felt the urge to explore the vast marshland beyond the Oradesh. After skirting the river for 3 or 4 miles, I found a rickety footbridge. While crossing over, I could see the huts of a hamlet on my left. Apple trees, rows of tawny pine logs lying on a green bank, and the bright patches made on the turf by the scattered clothes of peasant girls, who, stark naked in shallow water, romped and yelled, heeding me as little as if I were the discarnate carrier of my present reminiscences. On the other side of the river, a dense crowd of small, bright blue male butterflies that had been tippling on the rich, trampled mud and cow dung through which I trudged rose all together into the spangled air and settled again as soon as I had passed. After making my way through some pine groves and alder scrub, I came to the bog. No sooner had my ear caught the hum of diptera around me, the guttural cry of a snipe overhead, the gulping sound of the morass under my foot, than I knew I would find here quite special Arctic butterflies, whose pictures, or better still, non-illustrated descriptions I had worshipped for several reasons. And the next moment I was among them. Over the small shrubs of bog bilberry with fruit of a dim, dreamy blue, over the brown eye of stagnant water, over moss and mire, over the flower spikes of the fragrant bog orchid, the Nochnaya Fialka of Russian poets, a dusky little fritillary bearing the name of a Norse goddess passed in low, skimming flight. Pretty Cordigera, a gem-like moth, buzzed all over its eulogenous food plant. I pursued rose-margined sulfurs, gray-marbled satyrs. Unmindful of the mosquitoes that furred my forearms, I stooped with a grunt of delight to snuff out the life of some silver-studded lepidopteron throbbing in the folds of my net. Through the smells of the bog, I caught the subtle perfume of butterfly wings on my fingers, a perfume which varies with the species, vanilla or lemon or musk, or a musty, sweetish odor difficult to define. Still unsated, I pressed forward. At last I saw I had come to the end of the marsh. The rising ground beyond was a paradise of lupines, columbines, and penstemons. Mariposa lilies bloomed under ponderosa pines. In the distance, fleeting cloud shadows dappled the dull green of slopes above timberline and the gray and white of Long's Peak. I confess I do not believe in time. I like to fold my magic carpet after use in such a way as to superimpose one part of the pattern upon another. Let visitors trip, and the highest enjoyment of timelessness in a landscape selected at random is when I stand among rare butterflies and their food plants. This is ecstasy, and behind the ecstasy is something else which is hard to explain. It is like a momentary vacuum into which rushes all that I love, a sense of oneness with sun and stone, a thrill of gratitude to whom it may concern, to the contrapuntal genius of human fate, or to tender ghosts humoring a lucky mortal. Chapter 7 1 In the early years of this century, a travel agency on Nevsky Avenue displayed a 3-foot-long model of an oak-brown international sleeping car. In delicate verisimilitude, it completely outranked the painted tin of my clockwork trains. Unfortunately, it was not for sale. One could make out the blue upholstery inside, the embossed leather lining of the compartment walls, their polished panels, inset mirrors, tulip-shaped reading lamps, and other maddening details. Spacious windows alternated with narrower ones, single or geminate, and some of these were of frosted glass. In a few of the compartments, the beds had been made. The then great and glamorous Nord Express, it was never the same after World War I, when its elegant brown became a nouveau riche blue, consisting solely of such international cars and running but twice a week, connected St. Petersburg with Paris. I would have said directly with Paris, had passengers not been obliged to change from one train to a superficially similar one at the Russo-German frontier, Verzhbolovo-Eidskunen, where the ample and lazy Russian 60.5-inch gauge was replaced by the 56.5-inch standard of Europe, and coal succeeded birch logs. In the far end of my mind, I can unravel, I think, at least 5 such journeys to Paris, with the Riviera or Biarritz as their ultimate destination. In 1909, the year I now single out, Our party consisted of 11 people and one dachshund. Wearing gloves and a traveling cap, my father sat reading a book in the compartment he shared with our tutor. My brother and I were separated from them by a washroom. My mother and her maid, Natasha, occupied a compartment adjacent to ours. Next came my two small sisters, their English governess, Miss Lavington, and a Russian nurse. The odd one of our party, my father's valet, Osip, whom a decade later the pedantic Bolsheviks were to shoot because he appropriated our bicycles instead of turning them over to the nation, had a stranger for companion. Historically and artistically, the year had started with a political cartoon in Punch, Goddess England bending over Goddess Italy, on whose head one of Messina's bricks has landed, probably the worst picture any earthquake has ever inspired. In April of that year, Perry had reached the North Pole. In May, Chaliapin had sung in Paris. In June, bothered by rumors of new and better Zeppelins, the United States War Department had told reporters of plans for an aerial navy. In July, Blériot had flown from Calais to Dover, with a little additional loop when he lost his bearings. It was late in August now. The firs and marshes of northwestern Russia sped by, and on the following day gave way to German pine woods and heather. At a collapsible table, my mother and I played a card game called Durachki. Although it was still broad daylight, our cards, a glass, and on a different plane, the locks of a suitcase were reflected in the window. Through forest and field, and in sudden ravines, and among scuttling cottages, those discarnate gamblers kept steadily playing on for steadily sparkling stakes. It was a long, very long game. On this gray winter morning, in the looking glass of my bright hotel room, I see shining the same, the very same locks of that now 70-year-old valise, a highish, heavyish, nécessaire de voyage of pigskin with HN elaborately interwoven in thick silver under a similar coronet, which had been bought in 1897 for my mother's wedding trip to Florence. In 1917, it transported from St. Petersburg to the Crimea, and then to London, a handful of jewels. Around 1930, it lost to a pawnbroker its expensive receptacles of crystal and silver, leaving empty the cunningly contrived leathern holders on the inside of the lid. But that loss has been amply recouped during the 30 years it then traveled with me, from Prague to Paris, from Saint-Nazaire to New York, and through the mirrors of more than 200 motel rooms and rented houses in 46 states. The fact that of our Russian heritage, the hardiest survivor proved to be a traveling bag is both logical and emblematic. Не будет ли ты ведустал? Haven't you had enough? Aren't you tired? My mother would ask, and then would be lost in thought as she slowly shuffled the cards.